Richard Whitmire is a former reporter and editorialist for USA Today and the author of The Bee Eater, about Michelle Rhee, and Why Boys Fail. Now, in his latest book, On the Rocket Ship, he turns his attention to, quote, how top charter schools are pushing the envelope. Through dozens of short chapters, he tells the story of the meteoric growth of the rocket ship network of charter schools, known as a leader in blended learning, along with the trials and tribulations of other charter chains. He looks for insights into how other charter schools and traditional public schools can learn from their successes and failures. We'll talk with Richard about the book, about rocket ship and other high-performing charter networks, and what he learned that surprised him most. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Yeah, you were here once before to discuss The Bee Eater, and glad to have you as a twofer. I think we've only had a few authors do more than one of these Education Next Book Club podcasts. So, and you were one of them. You're prolific.
I'm honored.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you a tough question on that right away, okay? Because some people have said that they thought The Bee Eater was a puff piece on Michelle Rhee. Right. And so without getting into that debate, let me ask, are those people going to see this book as a puff piece on Rocket Ship and on the other big charter school networks?
Well,
are you a big squish, Richard? Well, that's what we're asking here.
Let's start with the Michelle Rhee book, for one thing.
You can't help yourself.
No, I can. I'm still fighting that battle. So, yes, I was accused of being way too kind and sympathetic to her reforms. Yeah. And, of course, a lot of people hated what she did. But I have to say, I told you so. If you look at the federal test scores and you see that the mayor, improbably, hanging on to her reforms, has managed to position DC school kids as making the fastest gains in the nation for urban kids. So, I mean, I would say that I kind of treated her right. Not that I'm defensive about that, of course. Now, on the rocket ship, I doubt people will be saying that. You'd have to be pretty hardcore charter hater.
Yeah.
Because I started off on this book, I had permission to follow Rocket Ship for a year. And I think, all of us, and by all of us, I mean the founders and myself, expected that Rocket Ship would have another year where they're just absolutely killing it. And then I would segue from that into the other charters. And as it turned out, Rocket Ship had their, quote, learning year, to put it kindly. And they really got slammed for a couple of reasons. So I'm kind of thinking that if the co-founders had it to do over again, they might not have invited me to spend that year.
I got you. So it's interesting. So it's perhaps sympathetic, but also brutally honest. And the honest truth is that they have had some struggles. Okay, we're going to talk about all of that. Let me ask you a question as a kind of writer-to-writer question. I am curious about the format of this book. It's a little unusual. It is literally dozens of these very short chapters, a few chapters which are, I don't even know, they're chapters, they're a paragraph long, right? What were you thinking about? I mean, tell me about that. I find it to be actually very engaging. And for those of us that spend our days now reading short blog posts and things, it actually felt familiar.
You know, education books are tough to write, and you want to make them have a broader appeal than just for issue-oriented people. So I wanted a fast-paced narrative, and I thought, since I'm following them for a year, why not put a dateline on everything? And the book Class Warfare did that as an organizational tool, and I looked at that and I go, you know, this could really work here. So I was very conscious of every time I would write a chapter, I would come up with a date and a date line. And I think it works. Yeah, it makes it very readable.
And it does. And it's almost like little journal entries, but it makes it quite digestible. And it does make the pace go quite fast. When you were writing this book, did you say to yourself, I'm writing a book about Rocket Ship, or I'm writing a book about charter schools, or I'm writing a book about blended learning? How did you picture this in your mind?
Well, let me give you a little background on how I got into this in the first place.
Okay.
My very first book was Why Boys Fail. And to write that book, I wanted to find some schools where boys were faring as well as girls. And those schools are tough to find, but I found three, two of which were no excuses charter schools. And it was my first real exposure to these kinds of charters. And I was amazed. And I thought, you know, one day I'm going to come back and write about that. And then after Michelle Rhee ran ran into her political problems, I kind of, and I considered turning around DC schools to be like a last best chance for making a real progress in a troubled urban school district. So when things went south, I threw up my hands and go, now's the time to do charter schools. But I wanted a narrative. I wanted to follow a particular operator. So I had never even heard of Rocket Ship at the time. But I started asking around. I said, what's a small charter CMO that thinks big? And everyone kept pointing me to San Jose. And so I went to San Jose and chose Rocket Ship.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Let's get into the book. So you launch right in with an introduction that includes the Fibonacci sequence. Did I say that right?
Oh, Fibonacci.
Fibonacci. Thank you. The Fibonacci sequence. With a name like Petrilli, I should say that right. disruptive innovation and talk about closing the achievement gap. All right. So what does all of this, these great buzzwords and terms mean?
Well, as I said, I wanted to pick a charter that had incredible ambitions. And this charter is very different. It was the primary founder is a guy by the name of John Danner, and he's a Stanford-educated electrical engineer and internet entrepreneur who created one of the very first internet advertising companies and sold to DoubleClick, lots of millions, and decided that education would be his next startup. And so everything about Rocket Ship is kind of like a Silicon Valley startup, and that makes it especially appealing. John Danner thinks big, and so he decided that his charter schools were going to solve the achievement gap in the United States, almost on their own. And so he wanted a million students, you know, in 30 years. And so that's where I got the Fibonacci sequence about the numbers that add up so quickly. That was a theory anyway. And of course, they've scaled back considerably.
Interesting. And a lot of talk about disruptive innovation being a positive thing, right? That we talk about this in the tech world, that you see these upstarts that take down these huge behemoths. And why haven't we seen something similar in public education, where we have these monolithic bureaucracies lumbering along and they seem so ripe for disruptive innovation?
Exactly. You don't, of course, as you point out, you don't see it among these large urban school districts, but you do see it in these charters. And Rocket Ship does everything different. It's not just the blended learning. It's how you build a building. It's who you hire as teachers. It's who you promote as teachers. Everything, every part of it was treated more like a startup. So it was interesting to see what happened with that. Some of it worked out, some of it didn't work out. But at least they were trying. At least they were reinventing themselves as compared to, contrasted with, let's say, St. Louis public schools, Baltimore public schools, Detroit. It's interesting to see a different approach taken.
All right. So let's talk some more about John Danner. He is here really the protagonist in this story, or at least for a lot of it, and a fascinating character. So as you said, he comes out of this internet startup phase of his life. He makes over $100 million. He decides he wants to do education because he has a real calling. I mean, he really cares about doing something mission oriented. So then what does he do once he has that insight?
Well, he started planning ahead, like, how do I get there? And he knew he had to teach. So here's this guy who ran this huge company, decides to go back and teach elementary school. And so his wife was in Nashville at the time, the law school there. So he taught in Nashville public schools, just as a regular, I think it was second, third grade elementary school. And he, like a lot of teachers, struggled until he figured out that the only way he could make progress was by customizing an education plan for each kid in his class. Mm-hmm. And when he succeeded, that was the big light bulb that went off. And that's the light bulb that shaped Rocket Ship, is personalized learning. And so he, of course, being an internet guy, a software guy, you know, tried to do a lot of that personalization with software.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, let's talk about his co-founder, another protagonist in this story, Preston Smith. Who's that?
Preston Smith is more of a traditional teacher, a TFA teacher who went in some tough districts there in San Jose. And he got picked to start a sort of a quasi charter school there. And then he met up with John Danner. Now, Danner by this time had come back from Nashville, and mm-hmm. Danner, being the classic business guy, knew that he needed something missing in his formula. He needed somebody who had been a principal. Okay. And so he started asking around, and he was introduced to Preston. And that's where the team formed.
So John Danner and Preston Smith team up, and they sit down and start fleshing out what's going to go into this charter school. And they decide that they're going to focus most of their energy on just three things. What are those three things?
Well, the first one is finding and developing talent in a different way. And John Danner, again, with his business background, looked at this and said, why should we do something that somebody else can do better? And so he thought that Teach for America was better at finding talent and developing talent. So why have a personnel department? Why devote somebody to recruiting if you can just lean on TFA? And so that's what they did. And their early schools would have at least two teachers who were first-year TFAers.
Yep.
And the balance of the school teachers were primarily TFAers who had gone through their 2 years and then were hired. And his idea was that we, Rocket Ship, can hang on to those TFAers longer than they stay at other schools because we are going to promote them rapidly. Mm-hmm. So for all those really talented TFAers who think, I'll put in my 2 years of teaching, sort of like a national service, mm-hmm. and then go to law school,
right.
Or go to Wall Street, we'll start promoting them right away, and then they'll stay in education.
And promoting them to go help start new rocket ship schools.
Yes, so you can have, I profile someone in there who's an assistant principal by year three mm-hmm. and a startup principal by year four.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't happen in normal schools.
Right.
So that was the plan.
Interesting. Okay, the second piece was technology, something the school's quite well known for.
Right. Well, he as I said, you know, in Nashville, his big takeaway was personalizing learning. And naturally, he thought that software, online learning, would be a natural way of doing that. So he and Preston started searching nationally for adaptive software. Mm-hmm. Now, adaptive software is the kind of software where a kid logs on and goes through a learning program, and when he or she starts making mistakes, they don't just take you back to step four. The software figures out what skill is it that this child is lacking, and then loops back on another pathway so the child learns that. In other words, it figures out how that child thinks. Mm-hmm. So they're looking around the country for adaptive software, and they find nothing. I mean, they looked for months and months and months, and they were shocked that there was nothing out there. Most of it was just software from textbook suppliers mm-hmm. who just put their textbooks online because that was profitable. But then they discovered Dreambox. And they discovered Dreambox at a time when Dreambox was about to go out of business. So it's a great story. Do you want me to tell the story now?
Yeah, let's hear about
okay.
this, about Dreambox. And about this guy, Ben Slivka, is another character in this story.
Yeah, and he's an amazing character. Talk about an internet software entrepreneur. He was one of the key people behind Microsoft Explorer. So he cashed out of Microsoft, and decided, well, what should I do with my life? And reached kind of the same conclusion that John Danner did. And he wanted to build adaptive learning software. And so he and his buddies put together this amazing system and brought in then teachers to do the actual educational stuff on top of the platform. Mm-hmm. And it was truly adaptive. And as far as I can tell, it was the first adaptive software in the country. And so Danner finds it and he's all excited. And he calls in his buddy, Reed Hastings of Netflix fame. Mm-hmm. And so Reed comes over to Rocket Ship School and sees it in action and says, wow, this stuff's pretty good. He says, I happen to know the lead engineer over there. So he calls him up and says, hey, nice stuff you're doing. And the guy goes, oh, thanks, but my company's about to go out of business. It turned out that Dreambox had beautiful software, but a really bad business plan. And because they were targeting parents of really young kids, and parents, they didn't really know the kids needed this kind of work at that point.
Right.
So Reed steps in and buys the company, turns the company over to the Charter School Growth Fund, and then Rocket Ship works with Dreambox to make it better. So it's an amazing story.
This is, as you can tell, a lot of great characters. And again, there's something about it. These are these celebrities, right? And these bazillionaires who are all getting interested in education. Yeah. Okay, so the technology, we'll talk a little more about that as we go. And then this third point that they decide to focus on, which I've never heard anybody talk about in terms of rocket ship, is making Latino parents into education activists.
Yeah.
What is that about?
Well, when people talk about rocket ship, they always talk about it as being inventive, you know, blended learning especially. But after spending a year watching rocket ship, their real innovation was how they treated parents and how they developed parents into leaders. And without naming names, I can just here in D.C., I can walk down to some high-performing charter schools where parents are treated at arm's length. Mm-hmm. In other words, the more that kid is in the charter school culture rather than the toxic home culture, the better as far as they're concerned.
Right.
So parents are given lip service, but they're not really invited. They're not really embraced. Well, rocket ship did just the opposite. They did a community organizing approach. So let me give you an example. In any school, let's say of 500 kids, they assume that there's a core group of about 50 parents who can become active on all kinds of levels, not just the school, but beyond the school. Mm-hmm. And then among the 50, there are maybe 10, maybe even fewer than that, who can be developed into true leaders. Mm-hmm. And these are people who had, at the time, really have no idea they have this in them, but they see this leadership in them. Now, mm-hmm. Now, rocket ship isn't working alone on this. They're working through a community organizing group called PACT there, which is really good. And PACT did a lot of this work for them. So they would invite, PACT and rocket ship would invite parents to a back to school night, let's say, and they would talk to parents and listen to parents afterwards. And they found that the most effective parents were those who had a real sadness in their family. Something had happened, especially with a kid, and they had regret about it. Hmm. And they felt that they needed to do something about it. And they found, in the book, I profile this woman, Karen Martinez, whose stepsons had real trouble in school. One was in prison for a while, but she was determined that her two girls were going to be different. Well, she sent Daniela, her oldest, to a regular, you know, community school there, district school, and they pronounced Daniela to be essentially very backward, wasn't sure she could learn to read, assumed she had major problems. And so Karen, you know, just heard about rocket ship, took Danielle to rocket ship, and they worked with her and got her reading, got her back to being an excellent reader. Well, this, needless to say, radicalized Karen Martinez, and they developed her into someone who could appear at school board hearings to lobby for rocket ship. And she's gone on, and she now won an election on the Alum Rock school board there. So she now is a school board member, and her daughter Daniela is one of the Vergara plaintiffs. So they really struck gold when they found Karen Martinez.
That's very interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the politics of this as a good segue, and you know where that activism becomes quite important. So John Danner and Preston Smith, they developed this great plan for a charter school, and so John gets a hold of the local superintendent in San Jose and to go pitch him on this idea, and it just goes swimmingly, right?
the school superintendents in Santa Clara County were not enthusiastic about rocket ship coming into their districts, but it turns out that the county school board, Santa Clara County is huge. There are 31 school districts within Santa Clara County, which includes a lot of Silicon Valley. It turns out that this county board, which doesn't do all that much, frankly, they handle juvenile delinquents and oversee special education, mm-hmm. but that county board has the power to authorize charter schools. And they discovered the right people on that county board, and that county board can handle an appeal. So when a school district within the county turned down rocket ship, they went to the county board. And when rocket ship went to the county board, it wasn't just Preston and John. Mm-hmm. They brought along these activist parents, and these parents showed up by the hundreds. Yep. And so the school board, county school board looks at this sea of parents out there and goes, okay, we'll give you yes. what you want.
Thumbs up on this one.
Yeah.
Now, but talk a little bit more about this superintendent, I think in San Jose, because, you know, and on the one hand, from sort of John Danner's original perspective, he was very dismissive of this side, very old school, didn't want anything, didn't believe that these kids could learn. But you do interview the superintendent and try to get his perspective as well. What was that about? Is this just just sort of typical what we see all across the country as traditional superintendents hear about these charter school upstarts?
Nobody wants competition. And when you have especially a Latino leader like that who devotes his life to helping Hispanic kids, to have some, you know, elitely educated guy who grew up like John Danner, who grew up in the upper middle class, come in and say, you're doing a lousy job with your Hispanic students. Well, this doesn't go over well. I mean, John's kind of like, he doesn't mince words. You know what I mean? He just tells it like he sees it. So this did not go over well. And the superintendent was furious and made sure that, you know, that they turned that down. But then the school board overruled him.
Yeah, the county
school. County school board yeah. overruled him.
Very interesting. All right, let's talk some more about what's inside the schools. Let's talk about teachers. So you mentioned that they were going to use Teach for America, basically, to do their staffing, that they hired a lot of young teachers and promoted them rapidly. But how did they get these teachers to be effective in the classroom? Did they discover some kind of secret sauce there?
Yeah, so well, everyone knows that first-year teachers struggle. I mean, I certainly did. I was a first-year teacher, and I was terrible. And but they decided that they, Rocket Ship, could do something that many others couldn't do, and that is make a first-year TFA teacher effective. And to do that, they would have mentors in the classroom. Often the teacher would have an earbud in, and the principal or assistant principal would be in the back of the classroom, you know, talking to the teacher, saying, now look at, there's, you know, wow. Frederica over there. She's not paying any attention. Here's what you need to do here. Here's how you need to get this flow. Here's how you need to establish the culture.
Calling audibles from the back of the
calling
room.
Calling audibles. And so that's how, and they succeeded in that. Now that later ran into, they had to adjust that policy.
Yeah.
Shall I talk about that now?
Let's talk about it.
Well, that worked for years, several years. And then they discovered that they were putting so much time into those first year teachers that they had fewer resources to observe and mentor the teachers who were in their second, third, and fourth years. And so they were getting gains in some schools. The teachers making the most gains with the kids were the first year TFAers, but the others would slip back.
Huh.
So it was just a slight adjustment. They started hiring their own teachers. And for example, most schools now, instead of taking 2 first year TFAers each year, they'll whittle that back to 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just hard to sustain that, right? Especially if it was Preston Smith, who is the one in the back of the classroom as this fantastic principal. He could only do that if you're talking about, you know, a small school. Once it grows, once you talk about multiple schools, then that model perhaps doesn't work anymore.
And that's one reason that Rocket Ship ran into a wall, so to speak.
Yes.
And they're like a lot of charter groups, you know, and they've got 4 or 5 or 6 schools and they're, you know, hitting these home runs. They think, you know, we've got this problem solved. We're on it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get slammed and they go, oh my God, you know, we don't have the answer.
So let's talk about that part of the story. All right. So it's 2012 and it sounds like from the book, they run into problems on 2 fronts. First of all, they see something of a plateau in their test scores, and their financial model starts to fall apart.
Well, their financial model is falling apart because the state of California, first of all, gives these charters almost nothing per kid, $6,500. Now compare that to Washington, D.C., where they get $12,000.
Or more.
More. I mean, it's nothing. And then the state starts getting behind on payments. And, you know, then there's a cutback. And they're looking at this going, oh my God, so, you know, what are we going to do? Plus, we're doing like B-plus work with the kids, these scores, we need to boost it. So they would need to do 2 things at one time, save money and boost, you know, performance. Well, you know,
doing more with less. Yes.
Yeah.
We reformers like to talk about that.
We all know how that works out. So in short, it didn't work out. They took a giant leap. And it usually in 2 grades in each school, they would, in many cases, just knock down walls, and they combined all grades into 1 classroom. And so you'd have over 100 kids in one area and then all the teachers. And the idea was that A, this would save money, and B, there'd be more personalized learning because one teacher could go do a large group instruction while the other two teachers were carving a, kids out, let's say 10 per group, who needed special attention in certain areas. So there you have it. You save money.
And you save money because they boosted the class size. The per teacher ratio was going up as well.
Yes. Yeah. And they have more personalized learning. Well, it turns out that, that kind of stuff is really hard to do. Yeah. It's not necessarily a bad idea, but it's really, really hard to do. And the teachers need special training and they didn't get it. They needed, you know, special supports. And the irony is that at the end of the year, those classes, combined classes, did all right. They did pretty well. But the other classes are the ones where the teachers were ignored, kind of cratered. Because the teachers weren't getting any oversight. They weren't getting any mentoring. They were just left on their own. And so now Rocket Ship has walked that back. And just a week ago, Preston put out a release, an explanation, and says it's over. That experiment is over.
That's fascinating. And the next year, not only were the scores flat, the next year they dipped quite a bit.
Yes,
right?
Every single school went down. And the reason... there are several reasons. One is this so-called model change, which I just described.
Yep.
The other is just when a charter group starts growing, they realize kind of what they didn't do along the way that needs to be done. In Rocket Ship's case, they needed to standardize literacy and math curriculum that they didn't have. And so they have that now. And so now what they've done is they've taken a learning year, if you will. No more model change. That's gone. And they now have a standardized math and literacy curriculum. So they essentially went into a slowdown. They stopped their sort of really hit the brakes on their national expansion, just put back some launches and made sure that everything is okay in each of their schools before they ramp up again. And according to internal testing, they are back on track. That's what Preston tells me.
Now, one of their expansions was to Milwaukee. This was a city where people got on a plane and flew out to California to see Rocket Ship, and they recruited Rocket Ship to come to them. They wanted this school in their city. We've seen this in other places too. How did it go in Milwaukee?
Well, Milwaukee is such an interesting story because in theory, Milwaukee is at the vanguard of education reform. 20 years ago, they had instituted, they brought in school choice for everyone there, vouchers for everyone, including to parochial schools, thinking that parents would naturally take their kids to the better schools and the better schools would flourish and the bad ones would fall to the wayside. Well, what that pioneering work discovered was that choice alone doesn't do it.
Yep.
It didn't create great schools. Parents took their kids to schools near their work. They took their kids to schools where the football team was better. If your kid's flunking French in one school, they found out that you could switch to another school and maybe you don't get that F after all. So that it wasn't creating great schools. And Milwaukee leaders, you know, starting with the mayor, everyone, the Chamber of Commerce figured that out and that they needed to kickstart this whole system by infusing it with some really high performing charter schools. And that's why they recruited Rocket Ship so heavily.
And did Rocket Ship come through? I mean, did they deliver the goods?
Well, they had a rough entry there. There was so much turmoil going on in San Jose that they kind of took their eye off the Milwaukee launch as far as recruiting students. So they opened the school 100 kids short. Over 100 kids short, which means they lost a lot of money there, a lot of money. But if you look at that school, I mean, I've been in enough schools to know when one's functioning at a very high level. And also I know their internal test scores. And they started in Milwaukee with a group of students that's further behind in academic school skills than any school that they had in California. And they've already had huge leaps there. So I predict it's going to be a big success. And of course, another reason that they opened under-enrolled was that school was really fought there in Milwaukee. Not just the union, it was the school district. Because I think the school district saw what was coming there, you know, because Rocket Ship's going to bring 8 schools and parents are going to start choosing schools based on academic outcomes. And they're in trouble because the surrounding elementary schools there are really not doing well. If you look at the three schools nearest to that rocket ship school and look at their greatschools.org rating, it no better than 3 out of 10.
So, you know, you watched this very difficult year, okay, and we have here John Danner wanting to have 1 million kids very quickly and closing achievement gaps, and then they run into trouble with, you know, because they don't have a curriculum. I mean, some of this from the outside, it sounds like, come on, they just don't have their act together. These people have much greater ambition than they actually had know-how, yet you still sound quite bullish on it. You think this rocket ship thing could actually work at scale?
Well, I think so. I mean, with the at their DNA is reinventing themselves, and they're very good at that. And so when they do hit a wall, they reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they've done. And now their test scores are back up. They're still doing incredibly well with Latino kids. And I predict that they'll be in the elite. And of course, my book is about the high performing charter schools, which I define as roughly the top 15-20%. Mm-hmm. And I think rocket ship belongs there, still belongs there, and in years to come, we'll be, you know, reading about them as much as KIPP or Uncommon Schools.
Okay. Well, at the end of the book, you do take a little bit of a step back and talk about school reform from a wider perspective and charter schools. You talk about a couple of cities that are doing interesting things: Memphis, Spring Branch, which is in Houston, Denver. You think that these cities are onto something?
Yeah, I do. I think, and this is. If you ask what I'm surprised about in this book, I'm surprised to find there are so many avenues for expanding the reach of these top charter schools. I came into the book thinking that this is only going to happen by groups like Rocket Ship expanding quickly. And then I realize, I look at a place like Spring Branch, where, and I'll tell the story of Spring Branch, the superintendent there, you know, one day just got curious, and he wondered what's going on with those Yes Prep charter schools. And he went and toured one, and he was blown away because my own sons could benefit from that. Mm-hmm. And so then he went to visit a KIPP school there in Houston and had the same reaction. And so what he wanted to do was not necessarily bring those charters into his district. He wanted those charters in his district, in his schools, and interacting with his teachers. So he wanted everybody to learn from that. He was looking for two things from then. He loved the urgency that he saw in those two schools, and he loved the culture. He wanted his own teachers to have that. So he took two middle schools and put KIPP in one and Yes Prep in the other. And in those, and they're in opposite end, different ends, but they have a common professional development. The kids share electives. And he's really trying to transform an entire school district based on these high-performing charters. So this is something special going on. In Spring Branch, mm-hmm. there are hundreds of school districts around this country that could do what Spring Branch is doing without the whole controversy that you see elsewhere.
And you think they might?
Others? I hope so. It makes so much sense because you can sidestep the controversy. And here's what that superintendent in Spring Branch gets out of this. In those two middle schools, those higher scoring kids in KIPP and Yes Prep, they count. Those scores count toward mm-hmm. that school. So he looks better. All the teachers get better. Parents have more choice. It's a win-win.
And finally, Richard, so when you think about the charter school movement writ large, I mean, now you've said that coming into this book, you saw with the political turmoil in a place like D.C., how hard it is to do district reform. But we've also seen some real political pushback on charters. You see mayor come into New York City, who is a hero of the left, and right away went about trying to change the policy of giving facilities to these schools. You're seeing, you know, more militant teacher union folks around the country. So, you know, what's happening? I mean, do you think that the charter school strategy, particularly the high quality charter school strategy, you really do believe that this is something that's politically sustainable?
I do, because I see two things developing. And you mentioned New York, and I would add Boston, and I would add Los Angeles, where essentially there are fights over charters. The superintendents don't want the competition, and the unions don't want the competition. You can go that way, but once you get on an airplane, start traveling around the country, you discover amazing things going on. Not everyone is going through this fight. And just yesterday, I was in Denver, where they've got quite a striking compact with charters, and they took two locally developed, homegrown, if you will, charters, and they brought them into their into the Denver public schools, into that space. And they've got common professional development days. And there's an agreement that goes with it. When the charters come in, they have to take more special ed kids. Mm-hmm. And there have been some studies about why Denver public school kids have seen like 2 or 3 years of rising test scores. And the conclusion is obvious. It's because of these charters coming in. They're welcoming the charters, just as they did in Spring Branch. So there is a way of doing this without all the fights, and you know, where kids can, all kids can benefit.
And that would be the, I guess, the message then to what? To, you would hope that superintendents would pick this book up, that maybe politicians, and see that it doesn't have to be the traditional system against charter schools or the unions against charter schools, that there is a way to work together.
I think that's true. It doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. It really doesn't. There are plenty of places, and I would start with Denver and then Spring Branch, where it's a win-win.
All right. Well, we will let that be the final word. Let me tell you again, the name of the book is On the Rocket Ship, How Top Charter Schools Are Pushing the Envelope. It is by Richard Whitmire, out by Josie Bass. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
Thanks for inviting me.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.